Hello and welcome to the Louder Than Words podcast, the pod about ideas that improve lives and nature. I'm Jules Pretty. In this episode, we're talking about the seven salty seas and the double crisis of climate and biodiversity. Why should we be concerned about the sea and the ocean? What is happening? Is there some good news out there? And what does the future hold for all of us? I'm delighted to welcome two guests from the University of Essex and one from WWF UK, Michelle Taylor and Natalie Hicks from the School of Life Sciences, Simon Walmsley, the Chief Marine Advisor for WWF, the Worldwide Fund for Nature. Thanks so much for joining us today. Let's start with a big question and an echo from 1,000 years ago. The Seafarer was the famed Old English Anglo-Saxon poem that exists on a single fragment of parchment. It was written 1,000 years ago. It's a lament that begins in this way. I can sing a life story about myself. I will never believe that earthly wealth stands eternal for a person. And the poem has the seafarer travelling out and coming back again. Those days are past, he concludes, all the pomp of kingdoms of the earth. So there was a link to about nature and how we live and how we might damage things, even back then. You three have seen the sea up close. You've been under the surface that hides so much. You've both got wet feet. Simon as well. How do things look to you? What changes have you seen in recent years in the work that you've been doing? Michelle, let's start.
That's an interesting... I've never heard that poem, actually. That's nice. I'm a deep sea marine biologist, so I do have the pleasure of seeing bits of the ocean that perhaps we don't see very often. And it's always quite jarring when you find human intervention in every section of it. I don't think we've been on an expedition, even to some of the most isolated places where only 5 ships have ever been in the Weddell Sea, you still find influence of humans. And that's really quite shocking, because we like to think that there are some wildernesses down there, but I'm beginning to think there are very few and far between.
Even in the deepest sea.
Even in the deepest sea.
Yeah. Natalie, what about you?
Yeah, similar to Michelle, really. I work on coastal and offshore. And one thing that is always amazing is the ability of the ocean to absorb some of the human activity. So we're learning the ability of the ocean to absorb so much of the carbon we're emitting and the impacts that has on a global scale. And like Michelle, we will be out at sea, pull up some of the seabed to have a look at it, and we find plastic wrappers or evidence of humans, even though there's no obvious signs of humans anywhere else on the horizon. It's just incredible.
Simon.
Well, it's another polar story from me. A number of years ago, I was in Greenland, and we were talking to local fishermen there, and they were catching mackerel. And they don't even have a name for the mackerel. They obviously enjoy eating them, but they don't have a name for the mackerel. And these are the mackerel, the same species of mackerel that we catch off the UK. So what's known as biotope shift, because the ocean temperatures are changing. And I've seen that directly. And whether that benefits the ecosystem or not, I don't know yet. We don't know yet, but that's an issue in itself.
So it's certainly changing. That's what we're seeing, for sure. Well, we'll come back to some of the kind of problems that we've seen and possible kind of solutions, whether they're technical or scientific or political. But let's just talk a bit about kind of astonishment. What have you seen in your work that has led you to draw a sharp breath, to make you go, isn't that fantastic about this planet? What is it that's there that we will celebrate, be astonished about, and then also be concerned when there's damage to it?
My favourite things in the world probably are deep sea coral. I maybe like them a little bit too much. But I've worked on the taxonomy, described new species, and I'm constantly surprised at just how biodiverse they are and how many new species are down there. And the things that live on and in and around them. The fact that we have this entire area of our planet that is so unexplored and so new and so exciting and potentially so useful to humans in terms of bioprospecting. Some really interesting compounds have been found in deep sea sponges and deep sea corals. So I think that kind of voyage of discovery that's still possible. I know everybody loves talking about getting to Mars and spending billions of pounds trying to live on another planet, and we've just barely scratched the surface of this one. So that joy of discovery. And any deep sea videos, really. I mean, anything with a Dumbo octopus is just going to have me joyful. They're the cutest thing. So I think the fact that there are creatures that are weird and wonderful and getting along with their wonderful little lives, and we just don't even know much about them.
So with corals, I mean, if you mention coral, we would think of, you know, the bright blue sea, the clear water, the fantastic colours, then the harm to corals when they've died off. But you're talking about another kind of environment altogether, aren't you?
Very much so. So corals occur in every single ocean, all the way from shallow to deep, really deep, like down a few kilometres, some deep as 6 kilometres. Now, these corals, unlike the ones in tropical shallow environments where we can go on holiday and drink cocktails, those ones have got tiny little algae that live inside of them that rely on the sun, so they have to be in the top sunlit sections of our ocean. Whereas the deep ones rely on everything that falls down through the water column and gets eaten and falls in bits on the way down. It's called marine snow, and it's that background to every single deep sea video you've probably seen. So that's what deep sea coral exist on. And it is kind of a slow pace of life in the deep sea. Things tend to age a little later, be a bit older. And some of the deepest, some of the oldest corals that we've ever aged are 4,500 years old.
That's individual organisms.
That's one individual organism. So they are some of the oldest living things on this planet. And we continue to find new ones every single pretty much dive we go on if we're using a remote operated vehicle. So they're very aged, but that also means that they're quite vulnerable, because if they were to be removed, it's going to take a very long time to restore that ecosystem back to what it was.
So we're getting a sense of there being kind of astonishing things that are hidden from our normal view, if I use that in the kind of broadest sense. So let's kind of pick that up in a moment or two. Natalie, what about you? What sorts of things have kind of astonished you in your work?
I think one of the things that's really stood out for me in the last few years is the amazing capacity the ocean has to mitigate what we're doing on our planet. So it covers such a huge proportion of the Earth, and we're becoming increasingly aware that it not only plays a role in absorbing CO2 and absorbing a lot of the heat, but it also influences our weather patterns. So whether you live by the sea or not, you're still going to be affected by what happens in the ocean. And one of the things that always amazes me is the power of the sea. We spend a lot of time, particularly in coastal nations, trying to bolster our sea defences, traditionally using hard defences to keep the sea out. And the sea always finds a way to come around that. And we're now learning that if we work with the sea and maybe go at it through, say, a nature-based solution approach and restore some of these habitats to what the sea's used to, the sea responds a lot better as well. So we take away not only that threat from coastal flooding and things like that, but we enhance the biodiversity and help nature store some of the carbon that we're trying to get rid of at the moment.
So nature-based solutions, Simon, is going to be part of the approach that you've been working with WWF and partner organisations. Could you just say a little bit about what you think are the kind of priorities there, how we could work, as Natalie was saying there, with nature to find some ways to lever up change rather more quickly than many would think is possible?
Well, the way we approach nature-based solutions is what we call through the triple challenge. So it's the benefit of nature, it's the benefit to the climate, but it's also the benefit to people as well. And you have to include people when you're looking at nature-based solutions, because if you protect an area of salt marsh, obviously that has economic and ecosystem goods and service value. So I think the people side of this is incredibly important in mangrove conservation, salt marsh, seagrass. And we've got a big project in Wales at the moment with Project Seagrass. And part of the issue with that was getting the locals and the communities involved with that in terms of the value to them. So they don't always see the value of climate change and of mitigation. They want to see amenity value. They want to see fisheries get better. So it's all about communicating how these nature-based solutions benefit people, planet, and climate.
And do you find that in your engagement with, you're talking about kind of local people, there's kind of locally elected politicians, there's nationally, there's international. Do you find that there's some movement in this thinking about how we can work with nature more to find positive outcomes? We know what a lot of the problems are. We might come to those in a moment. But how we can then perhaps take a new approach to things?
Yeah, I do see a change. I think decision makers at different levels are beginning to recognise the potential of the sea, but it's very, very slow. I think through stories like seagrass and salt marsh and mangroves, that's a great start. And those happen to be the habitats that are recognised under the IPCC and the UNFCCC mitigation umbrella. But we must go much further than that in terms of the potential of the oceans. Natalie mentioned, you know, some of those issues, sediments, for instance. I think, you know, sediments are the biggest carbon store on the whole planet, and yet very little recognition of the impacts of sediment, for instance, from trawling, which we can't actually measure at the moment how much a trawl impacts an area in terms of carbon. We can't measure what's released to the atmosphere. I think some serious research needs to go into those areas so we can actually measure the impact and actually do something about it and give this data to decision makers to actually make positive decisions.
Fantastic. Natalie's waving her hands in agreement there. Take the, go a little bit further about kind of sediment and mud then. I think these are two of your favourite things.
They are indeed two of my favourite things, not mutually exclusive either. So Simon's already talked about mangrove, salt marsh and seagrass, and these are recognised as what we would call blue carbon habitats. So they are coastal habitats that take up a lot of our carbon, predominantly through photosynthesis, so plants are taking it up. And then a lot of that ends up being stored in the sediments that are either within these habitats or move further offshore. Now, recently, we've had some amazing research with international colleagues looking at understanding the role of these sediments. And it's been absolutely incredible when you think about how much carbon is stored in the seabed. So you don't think about the mud and the sand that's sitting underneath the ocean, but they store hundreds to thousands of millions of tons of CO2. And Simon's already discussed the potential impact human activities may have, trawling, dredging. We don't yet have a full handle on how much carbon is in the sediment. We know it's a huge amount. It's probably the biggest carbon stock on the whole planet. And we don't know how activities are disrupting that. And we don't know if those stores are still accumulating carbon, how long it takes to accumulate, and how quickly we can erode it. So this is a massive priority. We really need to plug in the knowledge to work out the impact, but also something that we could relatively easily protect, even if we're doing it in small sections, would have a massive impact.
So we've got a kind of dilemma there of really important stuff that's literally hidden from view because it's very deep amongst the marine snow, as you were saying, Michelle. Things that are near shore that we understand better, but human activities such as trawling or other direct impacts upon the sea and the ocean, we know they're having an effect, but we're not sure how much. Yet we need to act sooner rather than later. So we need to find out stuff and yet also act quite quickly. And that's going to be a challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely. Michelle and I were talking about this yesterday. Often one of the reasons for not moving forward or making policies or something because we don't know what the exact outcome will be. But then the risk is not doing anything, having that inaction and knowing for certain that it's going to have a negative impact. So it's trying to sort of meet somewhere in the middle. One of the great things at the moment is I think it's not just scientists or policymakers involved in these sort of debates. We're seeing a lot of our younger people coming through and pushing forward, and it's pushing that drive for knowledge and action. And what's the harm in having a conservation approach on something? The worst case could be we have an area that's been conserved and has improved its ability to sequester carbon and improved biodiversity. That's not a bad trade-off.
Well, what about those, back to the corals then, the kind of the individual icons, because we can argue in a kind of policy arena for the research findings, for the kind of evidence that we have and the uncertainty that we might have and the need to act sooner than later. And we can also try to find kind of stories that tell us about the natural world that grab people's attention. And they could be the big iconic stuff. Whales have been a really important conservation success story of the last kind of 30 years, haven't they? But if we take corals as another example, Michelle, I mean, kind of your engagement with the public, do you find that people are kind of naturally interested in something like a coral because it has an iconic value? And you can see where I'm going to link to Simon in a moment about WWF and the dilemma there of having iconic animals, whether they're pandas or whales or orangutan, specific animals and species, and then actually saying, but it's not about that alone, it's about the whole habitat, it's about the whole environment. In the end, it's about the whole world, but you're starting somewhere.
It is a tough sell. We've discussed this with Nat before. Mud is a really tough sell to students and to the public alike. And coral perhaps is a slightly easier one, but I think it's a bit of doing both, and that's actually similar to what a lot of conservation is keyed around key iconic species, and then you have them as an umbrella for a wider area. And the deep sea is so misunderstood, and its role is really hard to kind of link to people's everyday lives, even though it is just crucial to most of the things we do, and especially weather, carbon, there's all of our geochemistry system is linked with the ocean. So it is a hard sell. So, and if it's possible to do it through umbrella species like coral, then that would probably be a nice iconic thing for the deep sea. But the messaging behind that, it might be better to frame it slightly more truthfully, to be honest. Maybe it's time for the rise of mud. Maybe this is it's time for in the sun.
Well, another way of putting that is the rise of the small bits in systems, if you want to kind of put it that way. The big things are what captured our attention, but if you get rid of all the small bits, if you get rid of the insects in land-based systems, we all know about the loss of the insect storm, the insect blizzard that's been talked about, that used to affect nighttime driving and now has gone. But if you take away the small bits, the big ones are going to suffer. Simon, what about those dilemmas for capturing attention from the iconic, but then also using that as a way to act for whole systems?
Well, let me empathise with the two in the studio. I'm an ex-polychaete biologist, benthic biologist, so I love mud too. So I'm a big fan.
I'm outnumbered here.
that dilemma is a good dilemma, and yes, we do use charismatic megafauna to kind of sell the story of what we're doing in a habitat sense, in an ecosystem sense. And corals is of course a very good example. But let me give you an example in the deep seas of where we haven't used charismatic megafauna, but we've used a polychaete. So I've been working on potential impacts of deep sea mining, particularly on manganese nodules, which are these nodules that lay in the abyssal plain. And there's a really great iconic image of two eyes sitting in a manganese nodule, and that's a polychaete. And we ask ourselves, why does this polychaete have eyes at 6 kilometers down under immense pressure and in the dark? Well, this polychaete actually looks at synapse firing, looks at nerve firing of its prey in the dark and attacks it. And that to me is completely amazing. And we use that image to show the impacts of deep sea mining because, we don't, to quote Joni Mitchell, we don't know what we've got till it's gone. And I'm showing my age now. That species could be used for things like retinal implants. There's just so much in the deep seas. I'll stop there because I'll get too excited about the deep seas and mud.
Fantastic. Polychaetes. Yeah.
I was actually in the Natural History Museum 2 weeks ago having a look at some animals that were taken from the nodules in the Pacific in the Clarendon-Clipperton Zone. And they're very small. I think that's what I didn't realise is they're tiny, but they're beautiful. The animals that have come off these nodules are incredible. And the diversity of things that have come off these nodules was insane. We thought there were probably going to be, because they all look very similar, these tiny little whip corals. We thought there were probably going to be a few species. And there were, I think it was 17 species in the end, 4 of which were new to science. And that was in one day. And that's from one expedition across those nodules. So, and I think it just goes to show how little we know about what's down there and how they exist. And I mentioned it earlier, but how do they live their lives? How are they communicating with each other? How are they sending these chemical pheromones that clearly they breed? There's all of this very understood, but very must be efficient. It must work. Sections of natural history and life that we don't understand, and that's extraordinary. There's literally an entire hidden dark world down there.
And it's under threat because of some of the things that we're doing. So let's just slip away and hear from BBC reporter and correspondent Tom Heap, who's written a new book called 39 Ways to Save the Planet, as we identify some of the glories of nature, some of the challenges, but then what we can do about it. I'm delighted to welcome Tom Heap, BBC reporter, writer and rural correspondent and author of the new book, 39 Ways to Save the Planet, a kind of echo of the 39 steps of John Buchan and Alfred Hitchcock. And this is a kind of thriller, big ideas that work. So, Tom, tell us a bit about the book and how it came about.
Well, I think it's really a story of redemption. That's the other narrative I'd give it. And a lot of our best stories are like that. When, you know, whatever it is, the focus of the story teeters on the brink of extinction and then pulls itself back. And I would argue that's a little overdramatic, but that's in a sense what we're doing. And the book grew out of a radio series itself for Radio 4, 39 Ways to Save the Planet, which has been running throughout this year. It's just come to an end. And it was always decided it was going to be a book as well. And some of the stories came directly from the radio. Others were researched separately, but they're pretty close. And the idea came because I felt in all the time I've been reporting on the environment that climate change is serious, urgent, and real. But a lot of the brilliant people and ideas but a lot of the brilliant people and their ideas to find solutions to this weren't getting the prominence and coverage they deserve. And that is wrong in two ways. One, because it's not the whole truth. And two, because if people aren't hearing about the solutions, they become either anxious, despairing, or gripped by denial.
Yeah. And so how have you seen in your kind of long period of reporting and engaging with the public, how have you seen those views on, particularly on the climate crisis, but related ones about biodiversity, changing rural landscapes? How have those changed, those public views that have led to the book?
Well, there's no doubt that they have become more serious, more important, more well known by most people. And one thing that I was actually very encouraged by was during our year and a half of COVID, that actually concern about climate and the environment increased. You might have thought that with this sort of real and present danger and death certificates being signed in front of you that mentioned something that a more long-term threat would kind of fall out of our consciousness, but it didn't, quite the reverse, which I found quite encouraging, really. The only thing I'd slightly caution is I've always been slightly concerned that a lot of the people we hear being concerned about the environment and concerned about climate change, and we often broadcast to and write and do our journalism to, are not necessarily the 80% of the population. They might be more like the 20% of the population. And the other point of this book, and indeed the series, was very deliberately to go out and find ways to engage the 80%.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a wonderful foreword that you have in the book from Arnold Schwarzenegger, who makes the quote from the Terminator film, "There's no fate but what we make for ourselves," which I thought was a kind of lovely quote about is this in our hands? Well, as you said, yes, it is. The 39 options that span energy, nature, farming, society, buildings, waste, in other words, just about everything, all things are connected. It's kind of in our hands. So do you feel then where we sit now at the end of the sharp bit of the pandemic, it's clearly going to go on a long time. How are you feeling about how this might all add up to some sort of grand project, a great transition, which is needed rather now than in the 2060s or 2070s? It's actions that have got to be turned out really quite sharpish, haven't they?
They certainly have. And the word I'd use, perhaps rather than the sort of binary optimistic or pessimistic, is excited. I'm excited by the people in this book. I'm excited by the ideas they've come up with. And I'm excited by the whole idea of the world transitioning to these kind of solutions, which gets us off the burning stuff train that we've been on for thousands of years, burning more stuff as a basis for growing our civilization. And, you know, I just find there are some brilliant ways out there, many of them having collateral benefits. That's the other thing. You know, so many of them, whether it be providing great homes for fish in terms of seagrass or seaweed, whether, you know, we've got a chapter on making sure all women get at least a secondary education. Well, almost the collateral benefits of that are more important almost than the climate benefit. There are so many ways like that. You think, well, this would be great anyway, even if it wasn't for the climate stuff. So very excited by that. And the other thing is, yes, it will require change. Yes, there are, if you like, winners and losers in this, and this is difficult for politics. But all the analysis of how much it would cost to meet our 1.5 degree goals are kind of in the region of 1-2% of GDP. You know, this is 1-2 pennies in the pound to save the world, and that seems like a banging deal, and it should be sold as such. And yes, there are transitions involving climate justice and people who haven't, you know, got the money to afford some things that might have to be more expensive. So that has to be managed, and jobs, you know, in coal have to be shifted to jobs, I don't know, in carbon capture and storage. All this has to be managed. But it is exciting. And one thing, just briefly going back to Arnold Schwarzenegger, we did an interview with him as well. And one of the things that he's actually thought a great deal about is how to sell the climate message, climate change message. And his first thing is, don't call it climate change, call it pollution, because everybody understands what pollution is. And nobody, even the greatest climate denier, likes pollution. So you sell it in that way. And it's quite an interesting approach, really. And it slightly comes from, he says, look, I know a little bit about this stuff because I sell movies to the masses, and I know what gets through to the, you know, the great bulk of the public. So I thought that was really interesting, a bit of analysis as well.
Thank you, Tom. That's absolutely the way that we tell the stories. We need the content, we need the form of language, and we need then to have the connection. So thank you very much for that. That's a wonderful introduction to the book, 39 Ways to Save the Planet. Tom Heap, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Welcome back. So let's have a little bit of a think for the last part of the pod, ideas that improve things for people and nature. What from our thinking and our knowledge of marine systems, the shallow, the deep, the undiscovered, the dark, as well as the bright, what do we think are the kind of priorities next? And where do they tie into perhaps, you know, economic benefits for the public that they and we simply don't know about, but they could, we could, if we look hard enough and we start to discover those, what sorts of things would you like to kind of point towards? Natalie, why don't we start? Perhaps on blue carbon.
Oh, absolutely. We've kind of touched on blue carbon, and we've seen blue carbon start to rise up international agendas, and we've seen it in the recent COP meetings, a number of them. It's becoming increasingly important, and it's forming a part of what nations are committing to as part of their nationally determined contributions. And the only way we can really achieve this is by engaging with people who live in these areas, so coastal habitats, people who live along the coast, people who work along the coast, and it's impossible to push forward any sort of action without engaging them. And Simon talked about this earlier with Project Seagrass. And so, for example, where we are in Essex, we're surrounded by beautiful salt marshes in various states of degradation and restoration. And so we've got a number of things at the moment where we're looking at how we can restore these habitats, what the benefits will that will be, not only to humans in terms of, say, tourism and water production and that sort of thing, fishing, but also co-benefits through biodiversity and reducing some of the flooding we see that happens every winter. There's usually a storm surge and we see more flooding. So one of the quick wins for us would be to focus our efforts on working out how to restore them. What's the best way? What does that buy us? And then how much carbon is that then sequestering as well? And I know that's something Simon's been looking at as well with WWF.
So if we could find ways for that kind of restoration, that regeneration, yeah, the nature-based solutions will help to deliver economic benefits as well as natural ones.
Absolutely. British Ecological Society released a report earlier this year that was focused on a number of nature-based solutions, particularly within the UK, what they look like, everything from agriculture to peatlands to rivers to coastal habitats, and what we have to do about it and where we're sitting at the moment. And that's a good way to start moving forward.
We know that NBS, nature-based solutions, will be a central part of the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC's sixth report next year will have this as a central part. So you feel as though there's a kind of strong wind blowing behind
Nature, Michelle. Nature is our best insurance policy. Economically, it's always going to be the best bang for buck. If you can keep it So, you know, restore, but also keep, maintain. So it sounds maybe... maybe it's a good lazy approach. So there's a lot of active things we could do, but there's also things we could just stop doing. So, you know, we could just stop trawling at the bottom of the deep sea. It's not a huge volume of fish and cash that we get from that. We could stop giving subsidies to various relatively impactful industries. So there may be inaction in some areas is just as good as action.
Absolutely. Simon, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the best thing we can do for the oceans and the planet generally is to cut emissions, GHG emissions. And I think that is the number one priority for everyone. But I think we can adopt a common sense approach with tools that we already have. For instance, marine protected areas. If governments actually did what they say they would do in marine protected areas, i.e. have effective management, then we would save a lot of biodiversity, possibly have benefits for food and also sequester more carbon and store more carbon. And we have those tools already and we have management plans. They're just not instigated, implemented. And I think if we can keep blue carbon in natural systems as nature intended, I think we're onto a winner.
Yeah. And if you've got a marine protected area, that's quite good evidence now that it doesn't just result in benefits within the area. There are spillover benefits into wider systems. You look after the fish there, the fishermen outside the system are going to get some benefits from it. So part of it will be the storytelling around, as you say, Michelle, the benefits of looking after, saving and then regenerating nature will be ones that affect a lot of people in a positive way.
The idea of storytelling and better storytelling, better integration of science with great storytellers is, I think, fundamental, because we have to go together. This is earthscape level. No nation is going to be able to do this on their own. None of us. And it's going to take people, and it's going to take people changing their minds or their minds being opened. But it's earthscape. So it's broad, but if the last few years have taught us anything, is if we really do put our minds to things, we can actually find solutions at that scale. It's not pretty. It will take a while, but it is possible.
And in that, people's attitudes and views will change fundamentally, won't they? We mentioned whales earlier on. I've spoken a lot to Shetland whalers who spent the 1950s and 1960s whaling in South Georgia in the South Atlantic. And that was the only work option they had. Shetland at the time, before oil was discovered, with its later side effects, there were no jobs. And so the young men from age 15 and 16 went to the South Atlantic to kill whales. And they all say, we'd never do that now. It was a brutal, horrible existence, but that was the only option we had. So they can look back and see just how much has changed and how things should be now. They and many others work on whaling trips when people are paying to go and look at stuff. And after you've looked, it's still there. And that's kind of one of the changes, isn't it? That we might find that people engage in ways that are non-exploitative. They don't use up nature in order to provide a benefit, but they generate new benefits on that side. Mm-hmm. Natalie, your thoughts on that?
Yes, just picking up on what Simon says, I think in terms of moving forward, there's two parts to solving the climate crisis. And the first one is something we do need to take action to cut our emissions. That is the biggest thing. And the second part is, and I think this is often the forgotten part, if we cut our emissions now, that CO2 is still in the atmosphere, it's still got to go somewhere, it's going to be absorbed. So we need to remove it. And the nature-based solutions provide the ideal way of doing that. And that's where nature's role really comes in.
Perfect. So two steps, cutting and then sucking up.
Yeah.
And we need them both.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Simon, final thoughts about how you're looking forward from the perspective of WWF, working in lots of different countries, but also working domestically within the UK, as you've mentioned. The changing views that people have, looking forward with some confidence, are you?
Let me give you an example of the power of basic awareness. Michelle's talked a lot about the deep seas. And I gave a presentation to the MOD to 1,000 submariners a couple of weeks ago. And it was virtual. It was on Zoom, but I was talking about hydrothermal vents and the questions that were coming back and forth on hydrothermal vents. And I don't think these submariners had any idea about the existence of these things. So I think that there's a massive inspiration in just letting people know that these things exist and what they do. And I think we need to use that more and more. Again, the power of storytelling. And once that is in people's psyche, then they have a relationship with it and they might take some action. But I think we're a way off that yet. And we've got to look at the economics, we've got to look at the ecosystems, goods and services, and provide the whole package.
Absolutely. So a final couple of words then around looking forward from the ideas that you've been working on, from the deep seas to the shallow shelves, as it were. Looking forward with kind of hope and confidence that we can do enough in the next decade to really make a difference, Michelle?
Always. I'm constantly amazed and inspired by this next generation of conservationists and marine scientists that are coming through. The ocean is the biggest component of this climate catastrophe and also the solution. So with 90% of the excessive heat that we've created being absorbed by the ocean and only 3% on land, ocean broadly, I think, is going to be central. Well, it is central to this. But yeah, people finding out about that and storytelling is crucial. But the youth, I think, is absolutely central to this. So knowledge and education. So education of our younger generations to the importance of this, I think, is really important.
Absolutely. I fully agree with Michelle. I think it's absolutely incredible seeing some of these young people step forward, particularly taking part in the on the international scale and talking about their fears and hopes for the future. I think that's definitely where we're moving to. I think the next decade is going to be the time, and hopefully we'll be looking back in a decade going 2021, end of a pandemic. In the last 18 months, 2 years, we've seen scientists, policymakers, etc., come together, work together, solve a problem relatively quickly. If we can have that same approach to climate change, then we're not dealing with the consequences, we're future planning and we're future-proofing the planet through our oceans.
Fantastic. So 53 years ago on Christmas Eve was the first time that humanity had seen a picture of a blue-green planet as a whole when Anders and Borman took the pictures from the Apollo of the planet, and it's mostly blue and a bit green. Yeah. And a bit white. And those astronauts talked about something called the overview effect, that once they'd seen it like that, the journey inwards became different. Everyone was kind of fundamentally changed by a view of the planet and the recognition that it's a kind of single system, mostly marine, as we've been talking about today. So thank you very much indeed to Simon Walmsley, Chief Marine Advisor from WWF, Michelle Taylor and Natalie Hicks from the School of Life Sciences at the University of Essex. Thank you very much indeed for your contributions to the pod Louder Than Words. That was Louder Than Words. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Have a look at the website for more information and do rate the pod if you can.